Welcome to another exciting episode of Calling the Divine TV. My name is Yujiro Seki. I'm a director, writer, and the producer of the documentary Calling the Divine. Calling the Divine is about Buddhist sculptors of Japan, and I'm ready to present it for the first time in the world. But before I do so, I thought it would be a great idea to introduce basic concept of Buddhism and the history of Buddhism, so that when you guys finally watch my documentary, you guys can watch it at the maximum value. So today we have a special episode. Again, we're going to talk about a very special subject, Tendai Buddhism. Well, it is very difficult for me to understand Tendai Buddhism. I don't know about you, but you know, definitely we're going to answer some of the most difficult questions today. We have a perfect person who can talk about this type of Buddhism. So let me introduce our Reverend Monshin Nemon. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to see you.
Wonderful. So just in case people who don't know anything about you, please tell me about yourself.
Monshin Nemon, I am the abbot of Tendai Shu New York Betsuin, which is the Tendai Buddhist Institute in English. And the Jianzun Tendaiji is the name of our temple, which is Compassionate Mountain Cloud Temple. And we are about 120 kilometers north of New York City in the Berkshire Mountains. And so we have people coming from all over our area to train here, to attend services here. And of course, we are a temple that does everything that a temple in Japan would do. And we're a branch of Enrakuji, which is the main temple of Tendai in on Mount Tiei, Japan, northeast of Kyoto. I trained in Japan on Hiezan. I trained at Taisho University and with my teacher at one of his temples. His name was Ichishima Shoshin, where I did my Shido Kegyo practice or esoteric practice, and then did the exoteric practice or Zengyo on Hiezan. That's probably all you need to know. And I should say that I'm a former professor of Asian studies at several colleges in the United States.
So today we're going to ask a burning question. What is Tendai Buddhism anyway? So please tell us a little bit about the history of Tendai Buddhism.
Well, Tendai is considered the mother, Hiezan, the center for Tendai, is considered the mother mountain of Buddhism in Japan, because the founders of the traditional schools of Buddhism, such as Jodo Shu, Jodo Shinshu, Rinzai Zen, Soto Zen, and Nichiren, were all Tendai monks. They all learned on Hiezan, and they then went to found their own schools. And so one of the distinctions between Tendai and the other schools of Buddhism is that the other schools are what they refer to as single practice schools. If you practice Jodo Shu or Pure Land Buddhism or Shinshu or New Pure Land Buddhism or Pure Land Buddhism, or you practice one of the Zen schools, or you practice Nichiren, you only have one practice. You're sitting meditation, you're reciting Nembutsu, you're reciting Daimokyu, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo if you're Nichiren, whereas Tendai incorporates all of those things. In addition, it incorporates esoteric or Mikyo in Japanese Buddhism. And to give you in many ways, Tendai systematized Buddhism from 804 when it was founded in 804. Remember, those other schools didn't start until around 1200, 1300 in that period of time. So Buddhism had been the dominant form along with Shingon Buddhism in Japan during that period of time. And Tendai was one of the first to really make Buddhism a religion of the people, as opposed to just of the court during the Heian period, from around 800 to 1200. And so it systematized four different schools of Buddhism early on, from the very beginning: Pure Land teachings, Shikan or meditation Zen teachings, esoteric teachings, and most importantly, perhaps, is Saicho replaced the Vinaya, Ritsu in Japanese, with the Bodhisattva vows. So it went from about 250 vows for monks and 350 vows for nuns to 10 major and 48 minor vows. That changed the nature of Buddhism in Japan significantly. And it moved Buddhism out of Nara, which had been the previous capital of Japan, to Kyoto. And Hiezan is just outside of Kyoto. And Kyoto was partially placed so that Hiezan would protect Kyoto. So Tendai is much more eclectic, if you will, than the other schools, which tend to focus, let's say, on Pure Land practice alone. The other thing that I would say, and please stop me if you think I'm going too long, because I could do the whole day just on this, is one of the other aspects that I think is really important about Tendai is the idea of Hungaku, or the doctrine of original enlightenment, meaning that the Buddha nature, that everyone has awakening within them, that it's already there. You don't have to attain it. You have to unveil it. You have to remove it. You have to remove the veil of samsara, the provisional world that we live in, and reveal the original Buddha nature within. That was really one of the major aspects of Tendai teaching that took hold throughout all the other schools of Buddhism in Japan. The other thing is that it made the middle way, in Sanskrit, Majjhimaka, it made the middle way a very important teaching in Japan that had not been there before. And that is that on the one hand, you have very ascetic practices, and then you have, and the absolute, and then on the other hand, you have the provisional world, our daily world, the mundane world that we live in all the time. And the extremes of both too much pleasure and too much asceticism, you really have to go to the middle and practice the middle way, practice between those two extremes. And between the absolute, which we can talk about later perhaps, and the provisional, is the idea that nirvana and samsara are really one and the same, that you make the difference between those. It's not something that you attain when you're dead. It's something that you can experience within this very lifetime. All right, so I would, in a very brief time, Tendai was established in 804, but it set the stage for all the other forms of Buddhism that you see in Japan today.
Wonderful, wonderful. That was a great introduction. So yes, when I hear about the Tendai, I hear about this monk. His name is Reverend Saicho. Who is Saicho?
Well, Saicho, whose posthumous name is Dengyo Daishi, was given by the emperor. Saicho, as I said, was the founder of Tendai Buddhism in 804. And he was as a young person, he was ordained at Todaiji in Nara at the age of 19. And he made a name for himself because of his scholarship, his ability to debate, his devotion, his practices, etc., and especially his ability for meditation. And so a very short version of this is that Emperor Kamu sent him to China with a delegation, a Japanese delegation, along with Kukai, the founder of Shingon Buddhism, to China specifically to bring back the teachings of the Lotus Sutra. Lotus Sutra had already been introduced in Japan, but there were more materials available that were not available in Japan. So he was sent specifically to bring back further Lotus teachings, to bring back new teachings of meditation, and specifically to be ordained in Mikyo or esoteric practices, because Emperor Kamu had learned from the Chinese that this was a very powerful way to protect the nation. And so in 804, he went and came back, and it did all that he was supposed to do. And he founded Tendai Shu. And Tendai Shu, when we say he went to obtain materials for Lotus Sutra, that also meant that he would be obtaining materials from Chinese Tiantai Buddhism. And Tiantai was the form of Buddhism. Tendai is the same character as Tiantai. It's just pronounced a Japanese way instead of a Chinese way. And so what effectively Saicho had done is he had brought those things back, and at the same time he had transformed and systematized Buddhism. And I'm going to make reference here to Zhuiyi in Chinese, or Chigi in Japanese, the founder of, in English we pronounce it Ji. He was the founder of Tiantai Buddhism in the 6th century. And his teachings became the philosophical basis for Tendai. So we have to keep that in mind. Well, Saicho was responsible for that. Now, Tiantai was known in Japan before that, but it wasn't practiced. Meditation had been done, but not really very well. Lotus Sutra was known. Prince Shotoku did commentary on the Lotus Sutra, so we know that that goes back to 6th century Japan, but the teachings of it were not really fully developed. And Mikyo had been introduced in some very preliminary ways, but was not fully formed yet. So Saicho was really responsible. And I want to use a quote, so if you'll excuse me reading for a moment, a quote from Saicho that tells a great deal about Saicho, but also a great deal about Tendai. And that is, and here's the quote, "Students shall be appointed to positions in keeping with their achievements. After 12 years training and study, those who are capable in both action and speech shall remain permanently on the mountain as leaders of the order. These are the treasures of the nation. Those who are capable in speech but not in action shall be teachers of the nation, and those capable in action but not in speech shall be the functionaries of the nation." And by functionaries, it meant we'll do things like building bridges and dams and serving administrative positions. And that says a great deal about Saicho, because he viewed Buddhism as not just something for the individual, for me as an individual to achieve nirvana or to attain presence in the Pure Land, but for each of us who are clergy, who are priests, monks, nuns, who go out, should be people who are able to work with other people, not just attain awakening for themselves. That was really an amazing concept in Japanese Buddhism at that time. So he set the stage, Saicho, set the stage for Tendai that developed in Japan, and then ultimately set the stage for all the other schools that came out of Tendai in many ways. So I think that, you know, I could talk about the other great leaders in Tendai, such as Anin and Enshin and Jichin and Yoku, etc. And each of them had a place, but we look at Saicho as being an exemplar because he was very humble, he was very disciplined, he was a scholar. He wasn't as flamboyant as, let's say, Kukai, but he was more down to earth and really was concerned about the people themselves.
Mm, Very, very interesting. So you mentioned about the Kukai. I know Kukai is a very important priest for Shingon. So Tendai and Shingon are like a contemporaries. So what the difference? I know that, you know, that everybody has a different answer to this, but you know, for your point of view, so some people are very confused.
Yeah, well, and it's somewhat confusing because in some ways they share a commonality in terms of Mikyo esoteric practices. And the esoteric practices are important to both Tendai and to Shingon. But to Shingon, that's their single practice. And so the esoteric practices in Shingon are referred to as Tomitsu, or the path of Mitsu, the path of Mikyo, the path of esoteric. Shingon, the word from Japanese, means true speech, which is the term for mantra. And Tendai, by comparison, had all of these other things, the Pure Land, the Zen meditations, the teachings from Tiantai. So Shingon was only interested in the Mikyo aspect, whereas, and that's Tomitsu, whereas Tendai is Taimitsu, which means with esoteric practices. Shingon, you do Mikyo, which in some ways is considered a shortcut to awakening. Well, Tendai introduced the idea of Hongaku, that we're already awakened, we just have to learn how to express it. And so therefore the esoteric practice was not as much the way to awakening as the other practices. Not only do you need to do, from a priest perspective, you need to learn how to do meditation, you need to learn how to do Pure Land practices, you need to learn how to do esoteric practices, etc. But no one practice is the only practice. For you, as a person, Yujiro, maybe meditation is better, or maybe Pure Land is better. For somebody else, maybe esoteric is better. There's no one way to attain the awakening that resides within us, or to reveal the awakening that resides within us. So Shingon is only esoteric practices, Tomitsu, and Tendai Shu is with esoteric practices, Taimitsu.
Wow. Thank you very much for that. That's why probably it calls syncretic Buddhism. Is that correct? Mm,
that's right. Mm. That's right.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. So in Tendai, I heard Lotus Sutra is also important. So what is Lotus Sutra anyway in Tendai Buddhism? Please tell us.
Well, the attention to the Lotus Sutra again goes back to Chinese Tiantai. And the Tiantai school was at the time in China in the 6th century referred to as the Lotus Sutra school. And the Lotus Sutra becomes important. And here I could give you a very scholarly interpretation, but I'll avoid that. Okay. The Lotus Sutra, you know, if you read, let's say, the Heart Sutra as an example, or the Lakamantara Sutra, they are deeply philosophical works that speak in many cases to the heart, but they require some deep training to really understand. The Lotus Sutra is not a sutra that breaks new ground except in two areas, but it's a sutra that's a summary of all the other sutras. So when you look and when we talk about this, it's referred to as Ekayana and complete teaching. So the Lotus Sutra became so important for several reasons, one of which is as a kind of summary, it provides a way of looking at Buddhist teachings, many different styles, all in one place. In the way that you would, you know, if you would order an encyclopedia that's got all the information in one place, it may not always be as deep as looking at the separate books, but it's all there. So that's one important aspect. It's all the teachings in one place. The second thing is that it's exciting. You've got parables. You've got people telling stories. I think sometimes when I read the Lotus Sutra 1,000 years ago, before you had Steven Spielberg, the Lotus Sutra was Steven Spielberg at that time. You have fantastic stories that people can relate to. It didn't just give you a philosophy. It gives you something that's interesting, something that captures your imagination, someplace that tells you a good story, but at the same time is imparting important Buddhist teachings. The other important aspect of that is it introduces in a very real way the idea of upaya, which is hoben in Japanese, or skillful means. And that became really important to East Asian Buddhism. You do not find it in Theravada. That's really an East Asian aspect of Buddhism. And this idea of upaya is used throughout it. And upaya basically in the Lotus Sutra refers to the fact that Shakyamuni Buddha taught different people of different capacities at different times in different ways so that they could best understand it. In other words, he taught farmers in a way that a farmer could understand it, merchants in a way that a merchant can understand it, scholars in a way that scholars can understand it. It may sound differently to the different groups, but it was all the same teaching. And the Lotus Sutra, just to give you another example, I think is important because I told you it tells a great story. But it also became really important in East Asian culture and Japanese culture because you'll find no theater picking up the Lotus Sutra, and many of the stories in No, Japanese No, are actually from the Lotus Sutra. The religiously, the art of the Lotus Sutra is important in Japanese culture in the same way that the Bible, the Christian Bible, is important to the cathedrals in Europe or in America. It was a way of displaying not only religious teachings, but aesthetic teachings that are very important. Poetry, when you think of the Goshuishu or the Manyushu, those ideas of poetry are poetry from the Lotus Sutra primarily. They expanded after that into other things, but they started as poetry from the Lotus Sutra. Tales of Genji borrows from the Lotus Sutra. If we look at America today, I would argue that the tale of the burning house, which I won't go into, it's one of the parables, really becomes important in relation to what we're looking at today in the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. And so the Lotus Sutra can become a mechanism or means of examining many different forms of life that we live every day. Many of the other sutra do not have that capacity, but the Lotus Sutra did, and it had an inordinate influence on East Asian culture. And just one other thing, without a doubt, the most recited sutra in Japan or in East Asia, China, Vietnam, Korea, is the Heart Sutra. Kanji, Zaibo, Zatsugyojin, Hanyahara, right? Mm-hmm. However, the Lotus Sutra in East Asian culture is the most used sutra for art, for storytelling, for representation. And so its significance went beyond just its religious meaning.
Wow. I'm utterly speechless. Oh, thank you so much.
I'm sorry if I went on too long.
No, it was great. So yes, but we're going to go on the next question. Okay. The next question is about the deity. You know, in Shingon Buddhism, mm-hmm. we have a Dainichi Nyorai, Dainichi Norai is considered one of the most important deity, Buddhist deity in Shingon Buddhism. I was wondering if there's anything like that in Tendai Buddhism as well. I heard about the Amitabha Buddha could be one of those deities, but you know, obviously I don't know anything about it. Please tell us.
Okay. Well, and I have to say that Dainichi Norai is also important in Tendai. Over my shoulder, you'll see on the left and the right, two mandala. On the right is Taizokai, on the left is Kongokai. And on the right, the center of that is Dainichi Norai. He's the root Buddha from which all the other Buddhas arose. And so in esoteric practices, he becomes very important. However, each temple in Tendai, it has its own flavor, let's call it. And each priest has their own set of practices. And a temple grew up in a particular way with a particular idea. So as an example, in Tokyo, you find Asakusa Sensoji, which is the largest temple in Tokyo. Well, that was originally a Tendai temple, and it still practices Tendai practices. But after the war, it became separate because of MacArthur, but that's a separate story. But the reason in that temple, Kanon Bosatsu is the Honzon, is the main image. And that's because there's a legend of how Kanon Bosatsu was found in the river nearby and placed on the shore, and it eventually became the center for worship in what later became Edo, and now we know as Tokyo. So at Asakusa Sensoji, Kanon Bosatsu is the Honzon. Another temple, it may be Fudomyo. It could be, I know a Japanese temple in Tokyo in which Enma, who's the guardian of hell, of the hell realm, is the Honzon. So probably the most represented images in Tendai, I would say, are number one would be Yakushi Nyorai, the medicine Buddha, which is Vaisakata Guru in Sanskrit. The medicine Buddha is extremely important. That was the first one that Saicho carved when he established his monastery on Hiyazan, for example. So that's very important. And in our temple, that's our main image, is Yakushi Nyorai, the medicine Buddha. Other temples, Kanon Bosatsu becomes very important because Tendai is devoted to compassion and then wisdom. That's one of the differences between Shingonshu. Shingonshu, you attain awakening through wisdom and then attain compassion. Tendai, you gain wisdom through compassion. Opposite ways. And compassion is very important. So often Kanon Bosatsu will be important. But there's other temples, and Buddhamita is very important. My teacher, Ichishima Sensei, his father really was much within Tendai, was much more of a Pure Land practitioner, even as a Tendai priest. So in that temple, Amida is the main image. But in the Kuri, it's Krishnagarbha, which is Jizo. So in Tendai, we have many, many different images that represent either a historical link, why the temple was founded in that particular location, or it will be the preference of a priest at some period in time. If the temple is more given to esoteric practices, it's probably going to be either Fudomyo or Bishamonten, which are both esoteric images. If the priest happens to be more devoted to Pure Land, it's going to be Amida. If the temple has a connection, like many pilgrimages, there are many Kanon Bosatsu pilgrimages in Japan, Avalokiteshvara pilgrimages. Half of those are typically Tendaishu, and so that's going to be Kanon Bosatsu. So really, there's an enormous number of images that you will see within Tendai. And again, because it's not a single practice school, it has a bit more freedom in terms of how they might express that particular temple's philosophy, inspiration, and that sort of thing.
Wonderful. My movie is about the Buddhist sculptors of Japan, as you know. But, you know, so we are always interested in the function of Butsudo. So in Tendai Buddhism, what the function of Butsudo? So what the view of the Butsudo, Buddhist sculptures for Tendai Buddhism? Please tell us.
I think that you have to look at it in two ways. And I'll refer to this as an orthodox way. What is the official way, so to speak? And the other is in the vernacular. What is the people's understanding? And each image has both vernacular and more official or orthodox view. And the view from an orthodox perspective is that the image that one is looking at, the sculpture that one is looking at, represents the qualities of Buddhism, the qualities of mind, the qualities of Kokoro, the qualities of Kokoro, heart, body, speech, and mind, spirit. Kokoro is very important. And so every morning we do the morning service, of the daily service, I'm sure we do the daily service. When we do the daily service, I do the mantra to Yakshi Nyorai, which is Om Bisaze, Bisaze, Bisaja, Sambri, Gyate, Sawaka. When I do that, I'm hoping to take on the qualities of healing. I'm hoping to take on the qualities of Yakshi Nyorai, of the medicine Buddha. And then during the day, I can use my hoben, my skillful means, upaya, to carry that out. Now that's from an orthodox perspective. From a vernacular perspective, when I attended Taisho University, on a certain day every month, I would be taking the train and I would see all these old people getting off at a stop near Taisho University. And there was a Tendai temple with Yakshi Nyorai, and they were going there because they had a bad shoulder or a bad hip or a bad knee. And they would go there and they would then talk to the monk, who would then pour water that onto them under their shoulder or their knee or whatever from Yakshi Nyorai that had come off of Yakshi Nyorai to heal them. So the images are seen in a vernacular sense, in a common people sense, as a form of healing. To look at Amida with sincerity, with one's whole heart, with Kokoro, with one's heart, mind, and spirit, for Amida, you hope to attain the pure land upon one's death. That is both an orthodox but also a vernacular idea, that it provides both inspiration, but it also helps you transform your mind in a way that makes it active and something positive happens to you. I don't know if that answered your question totally.
No, that's great. That's great. I love the difference between people who practice deeply with a statue versus regular people who might not have a deep understanding, but you know they want to connect with the statues anyway. Yeah, I love that.
And that's one of the reasons that the statues have to be beautiful. And by beauty, I don't mean always aesthetically beautiful. I mean, on my left shoulder is Bishamonten, if you can see him back there. And Bishamonten is one of the Shiteno, one of the four guardian deities. And he's the protection deity. And I wouldn't call him beautiful. He's a wrathful deity. He looks ferocious, but he gives you an idea. He gives you that sense of, I can conquer evil for the benefit of others. And so Bishamonten, by the way, becomes in Japan worship by businessmen to help their business to overcome difficulties. It becomes a symbol of a sense of well-being for the people, to of a protection of a village or a neighborhood or whatever it may be. And I think that those are really important things. The other thing, and I think it's something that Tanizaki Junichiro wrote about in Praise of Shadows. When we look at the gold on a statue when it's new, over time it changes. And think about 200 years ago when you were going to the temples and the temple was lit only with candles and maybe oil lamps. Now we have electric. And when we look at that image that's so gold, so bright gold, it looks a little bit garish, I think, for my aesthetic nature. However, as it gets older, the gold flakes away, it develops a patina, and the image seems to float above the shumadon, above the front altar, and it becomes a kind of inspiration. And so I think it's really important when we think of the sculpture and how the sculpture develops. If you have a deity, and I hope you don't mind my going on about this too much, but it's something that's close to my heart. When you look at a deity such as Bishamon Ten, he's in a sense easy to carve because he's active. He's in the heavens. There's movement that's inherent in the image. When you carve Nyorai, a standing Buddha of one who has attained awakening, like Yakshi Nyorai or Amida Nyorai, they're static. They have robes coming down, but it's harder to carve and it's harder to represent the importance. So it takes a much more skillful artist to represent that. And I think we diminish the importance sometimes, not only of what the image can mean, but also how it was created. And I would even argue that through the history of Buddhism, we don't have representations of the Buddhas until around the second century CE, a long time after 800 years or so after Shakyamuni Buddha's death. And during the Gandhara period, that's when we begin to see it. And the images themselves began to change the philosophy. The philosophy didn't just affect the image itself affected the philosophy. And so the images are vitally important to Buddhism, and that's from a Tendai perspective.
Wow, wonderful, beautiful. So please tell us what's going on in your world. So like what kind of activities you do, if you have a book or anything like that, anything that you want us to know about. So please tell us.
Well, our temple is located in the mountains, in the Berkshire Mountains, the foothills actually of the Berkshires. And we have a weekly meeting. Right now we're doing it by Zoom because of the COVID virus. We can't get together yet, so we're doing it by Zoom. We've been myself and all of our Sangha members, Dhanka members in Japanese, Sangha in Sanskrit, all of our Sangha members have been really very active in the events that have been taking place in the protests in the United States. We have been active in appearing at the protests and supporting our African American brothers and sisters during this period of time. And from a Buddhist perspective, that is vitally important. Last week, I was on a panel doing prayers for the protesters, in support of the protesters. Albany, New York is the largest city. It's the capital of New York, and it's the largest city near us. It's about 50 kilometers away. And so for me, it's only about a 30-minute drive, really. But I participated in an event which was with the mayor and the chief of police and the county executive and a president of one of the large universities. And so we're being very active in those things right now. The books, by the way, that I've written recently are really not books. They're more translations of esoteric texts, so they're not available to the public. only to other monks. However, we have I'm publishing about every week what's called the Jushoku's Journal, which is a few pages of reflection on what's happening at this time. And once a month we produce the Shingi, which has the Jushoku's meanderings, also other writings about this period of time. People are interested there. You can reach me at tendai@msn.com and I can make sure that you get on the link for that. That's Tendai, TENDAI@msn.com. And I'm happy to send out a link for those things. And you can even join the service. We're doing a service by Zoom every Wednesday night.
Wonderful, wonderful. So yes, we learned a lot today. I'm very excited. So if you guys think this information is useful, make sure to subscribe my YouTube channel, follow me on Twitter and Instagram, and like me on my Facebook, because that's how we do it in the 21st century. So thank you so much, Reverend Monshin Naemon, for coming here and explain to us about Tendai Buddhism.
I thank you very much, Yuroshiku. Be well. Thank you.